All right, there, we're good. Okay, so our seventh class, we finish up. It has been on a bit of a fast pace, but really, you know, it my hat is off to those who do this kind of teaching. It's kind of demanding doing it this way, and I really appreciate y'all's faithful attendance. We've had a pretty good solid crew throughout this class, so it's been really nice. So we are in, like I say, our seventh. We're dealing with the exile, the return of the remnant. Also, this is, I've got to finish up some of my objectives. So we've got some slides so that I can feel like I have accomplished that. So we've wanted you to learn your major Bible periods. We have repeated them. If y'all were a little younger, we would have done a lot more memory work to get that even more instilled in. I have kind of gone over the timeline order. I had even tonight was going to put in and have us kind of go through that. But with what I had in slides and stuff, I held off on that. But I hopefully have worked very hard in looking at God bringing his salvation to the world, and we're really, is going to be a major part of tonight's class as we finish up the Old Testament, because it's the New Testament then where that fulfillment comes. So we will take that opportunity to look a little bit at those years of silence where Daniel roars, but then also kind of that connection between the old and the new, again, reviewing some of that salvation, because the number one thing that you're really able to do with the Old Testament survey is to show that plan of salvation. We have listed the main topics of all of the books of the Old Testament. We unfortunately will probably kind of go through those kind of fast tonight, because if I hit all the words I have on those slides, we would be here for a couple of hours, but you have that. It's in the review sheets. And then kind of a slide that I have been working on, and kind of for this class, since it was the last class, I've tried, I think, a couple of slides showing, again, that relationship to man, but one in particular that I hopefully will show that relationship. All right, everybody unmute. Everyone get unmuted, because we got our major Bible periods to go through. All right, and always remember, Chester, I know for especially for you it's easier, just press that space bar down and you are unmuted. All right, what is our first Bible kind of periods that we had for this class? And fall.
And the fall,
and then there's also some flood in there. So you could easily spread those out, but that's usually we put that, those first 11 chapters of Genesis. What is our next Bible period?
Patriarchs.
All right. Y'all got to be fast. I want unison. I want an over-roar of answer here. Our next Bible period?
Exodus and Wanderings.
They get through Wandering. What do they do?
Conquest.
All right, Conquest and the Judges. Then the people say, hey, we want to be like all the other nations around about them, and that begins about a 120-year period of what?
United Kingdom.
Well, Solomon, too many wives gets him in too much trouble. Kingdom sort of goes 10 and 2. We call that time period the
Divided Kingdom.
Divided Kingdom. And kind of given our studies in Corinth, we probably could call the Divided Kingdom the Corinthian letter of the Old Testament. There's a lot that we can learn from their shortcomings. All right. The Northern Kingdom gets taken away, so we need to call our next Bible period the
Judah alone.
Still Judah alone, but it's a period that has a lot of lessons for us, so I separated out, and we call that the
All of Judah.
All of Judah. All right. Like I say, that is not a normal Bible period that you will find in most folks or whatever, but when I had 13 classes, I separated it. And so we still, since that material is based off of 13, we have that. Tonight, we're looking at two Bible periods, often put together, but really a lot happening in both, so that we would normally have them separated. And those two periods are?
Exile and return.
Exile and return.
And between the Testaments.
Exile and return. We are going to hit some on Between the Testament, but probably more than we should, given our time constraints. But that at least wasn't one of the 10 that we were listed, because I was debating on how deep I was going to get. But we're actually going to get a good bit into Between the Testaments, or at least a few slides. All right, so there's our Bible periods again. And again, we could kind of separate them out a little bit if we wanted to, or we were teaching, but this covers pretty much the periods that we have. So these are our Old Testament books. Kind of, I think, you know, where I got this, or I stole it, I steal quite a bit from good folks' work, that they did this with the New Testament survey. So when I did the Old Testament survey, I tried to do a similar sort of setup so that there was a connection there. So hopefully Marty will use his New Testament sort of this setup. But the other thing that's kind of nice is it gives you a color coding, and it can kind of give you a feel for, well, which books kind of are dealing with which time periods. Because that, I think, for people who are trying to learn the Bible and the Old Testament and all those books and all that time period, maybe this chart could be useful. So Genesis, again, we separate those first 11 chapters dealing with creation, the fall, the flood, and then in chapter 12, we're brought down to Abraham. And so there we kind of begin what we call the patriarch period. They end up at the end, Joseph at the end of Genesis says, we're going back. We have been promised that return. So he says, hey, take me up and all. And so then some 400 plus years later, we're introduced to Moses, and then that leaving there, this covenant at Sinai, Leviticus is the law, Numbers gets them from Kadesh Barneaim, or gets them up. And they're wondering, they said, hey, we can't take this. They lack the courage, the trust in God. They spend that 40 years, a generation is lost. And then Deuteronomy is that second giving. They're getting ready to cross over. Judges, those seven cycles of deliverance, just the depravity. And again, we are so fortunate to have that book of Ruth, because by the time we finish his Judges, it's pretty discouraging. And so to read about Ruth and her story gives us encouragement and realization that there are people who are faithful to the Lord. We then, Samuel finishes up our judgeship, so we have seven chapters with that. Then the rest of 1 Samuel deals with Saul. 2 Samuel deals with David. He goes from triumphs to sin to troubles. That's kind of the nice thing with 2 Samuel. You can kind of split it up into those. 1 Kings, we have Solomon. Chronicles is interesting. Remember, it's written after the return from exile. And it's kind of, again, to remind the people, to teach them. So the genealogy, the kingship of David, the first 9 chapters spend a lot of time talking about Solomon and the setting up of the temple and those deeds that he did. Now, not all of Psalm was written during the United Kingdom, but it was during the United Kingdom that kind of that poetry section started or were written. 1 Kings, after chapter 11, we deal with divided kingdom. We end with Omri, or Ahab. And as we said, the interesting thing is we're introduced to Ahab and his evilness. And then immediately after that, we're introduced to Elijah. So God responds. I mean, that is one thing that, you know, if you were saying what is a repetition story theme in the Old Testament, is God responds. And then also, I was debating, you know, just all the times, the covenants, the effort to return to the Lord to say, you know, we've looked at the plumb line, we're off, and that effort to say, we're making a covenant, we're making a promise to follow the Lord. And unfortunately, they are challenged with that. But I think that that is, especially when we look at Judah being taken away, an important thing to remember is that plumb line. And how do you know that you're really in line, that you're really there? Well, it's God's word, that absolute truth. One of the reasons I think we love Josiah so much is that when he heard what the law was, he just ripped his robe, realizing how far the nation was. Second Chronicles, after from chapter 10 on, deals with the kings of Judah. It doesn't talk about the kings of Israel. It's in 2 Kings, 1 Kings that we have Judah there. Our prophets that we go through today, our prophets are Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Those are our primary, as far as return, those are our three minor prophets. We have Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. All of those are dealing with the return. Now, we're still in Daniel during the captivity portion. So we're going to spend a little bit more time with Daniel tonight. And unfortunately, that is at the cost of not spending time with as much with these three prophets or with Ezekiel. So, again, part of what I've tried to do is repetition. So, creation and fall, that book of Genesis deals the first 11 chapters. We have the creation, the fall, the flood, Adam, Abel, Enoch, Noah are some names that you should know. And if I was really mean, I would have Nikki email out a little test and see if y'all could line up people to time. But I'm a nice guy. It's Christmas too, I guess. When we look, again, I'm a geography guy, so always kind of try to throw in a map here. So we have here up at the top the my kind of, I think it's Wonderland or whatever they call it. But the world was very different before the flood than after the flood. So very much changed. And what we really have as far as in the world we understand today is how the nations kind of spread out. As that's given, we have that understanding. With the patriarchs are really four guys that we think of: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. We throw Job in because that would have been the time period of him. And then there are also the ladies there, and they're a very important part of the interactions with their husbands and all. So that patriarch period, and again, he's wandering around. Abraham, his kids are wandering around in a land that is not theirs. They're sojourners. When we look at the age of the patriarchs, it is from Ur to Egypt, kind of the Fertile Crescent is the geographic parts that we deal with. We then come to that Exodus, people we really focus on, Moses, Aaron, Miriam, they're brought out. So Exodus is that leaving, deliverance from Egypt, building the tabernacle, giving the law. Leviticus is in there, so Numbers, Deuteronomy, those wilderness wanderings coming into the land. And so it's probably a busy map, but I must admit I kind of like it. So when we think of Exodus, we think really of the land of Egypt, part of Sinai. But Leviticus is hurrying wherever Mount Sinai was. Numbers is coming up into the land. If you want a good class on Numbers, listen to what Eric's teaching on Wednesday mornings. And Deuteronomy is getting ready to come right into the land. And then this map shows it in more detail. But, you know, if you're a person who gets, where are we at? I think at least this slide hopefully does a good job of kind of giving you a feel for what that is. So we then have the conquest, Joshua, Caleb, Rehab are all important people there. And really, it's also the nation of Israel. I mean, they're listed there in the heroes of faith, right? By faith, they walked around the walls of Jericho. And you look at the archaeological walls of Jericho, we say, oh, we would do it. You look at those walls and you'd have to ask, this is crazy. But those people listened to the Lord and they did it. Judges raised up when the people cried out from their depravities. And there's so many lessons to be learned from the judges. And then in the map there, we have kind of this central part. First of all, they're coming in. That Jericho Ai that gives them path up into this mountain where they immediately go to Shechem for the giving of the law, the people sitting on either side, the southern kings and then the northern kings. And there's one thing we hadn't really talked about, but, you know, it's like the Lord, well, it said, you know, a wasp sent amongst the people, all those leaders, you know, it wasn't Joshua having to go from town to town. It was these kings would form up an alliance, and they would go out to do battle with Joshua and would lose. The judges is conflict. So two different maps showing that. The other kind of with the color kind of throws you some. And that's actually one of the nice things with the black and white. And you kind of look at all those, and you really see that from every side, the people are attacked and oppressed. But the thing is, when they follow the Lord, when they listen to their judges, they're delivered. They're not under this oppression and all. So, but the people say, we want to be like the nations round about them. Saul, head, shoulder above everybody else, the image of a king. We have David and Solomon. Those are our three kings, really, of the United Kingdom. We have the other folks that are kind of in there, but those are our three main ones. Critical thing there is that David wants to build a house for the Lord, and also I think a very powerful lesson that our Lord says, who asked you? When have I ever said I wanted a house? But because you've done this, because you've cared, and this heart, that promise is made to David, that through him the seed's going to come. And then at the end, Solomon asked for wisdom. He's given it, other things, and it just, again, the wives do him in. But I think we've had mentioned that Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon in his old age. There's there that hope of his repentance when he saw what he was doing. Solomon's wealth was as a middleman. That trade going back and forth, he controlled all the roads. And as long as he controlled all the roads, money just poured in as people traveled through his lands. Then comes that divided kingdom, 931. It splits. There are no good kings in the north. We've talked about Jeroboam, his fear. God promised him, if you will obey, you'll have, you know, he was going to make that same promise of one dynasty. But Jeroboam was fearful, and he says, we're going to make our own worship so the people don't go down. And so they fall in 722. And then at least we're missing a couple of kings there, but at the end for there. But they keep going. So that's that divided kingdom period. So this is that same information on a timeline, just rearranged. Again, I show it. Some people get benefit from one, some from the other. At least on this slide, I'm able to explain, because not everyone says, oh, the early kings. But really, the early kings are that time when it was conflict between Judah and Israel. That Asa says, hey, Syria, I'm getting beat up. Come in, Syria, I'm getting beat up. You come and beat up on the northern kingdom. So that, you know, politically it was a great plan. But it then, until the Assyrians came, Syria caused grief to everybody. And then, because there are so many dynasties in the North Kingdom, we kind of do the periods or divide the divided kingdoms by the dynasties from the North. So that's sort of the Omri dynasty, which is Ahab's dad, Jehu, one mean chariot rider, and in their last days, kind of a confusing time period. So early Omri, Jehu, confusing. That sort of is your divided kingdom. Kind of our map here, I've kind of broken off from our maps, but I kind of like this one. I've thrown on the prophets. So, you know, if you wanted at least graphically, okay, when are the prophets? When are the kings? You know, which king goes where? This is kind of a nice slide. This is in the taken from the Wayfinder Bible again. Except for the prophets part, this is their basic thing. I've just added a little too. So Judah alone, we put there kind of Hezekiah as in that time period, Ahaz, his dad. Ahaz is really a discouraging king to me because he went everywhere except to God. Anything he would worship, he would turn to except God. And he paid the price. And Hezekiah, there's then that flip, so much the opposite of that. We have Hezekiah, we have his attempts at reform, turning to the Lord. He gets in trouble with the Babylonian envoys. So Judah alone is really Hezekiah, Manasseh, and Josiah. Those are the three kings really that count. Amon didn't. It wasn't around long enough to really make much of an impression. Again, as we've talked, and we're going to talk more about Manasseh, is the straw that broke the camel backs. The Lord's patience, and the Lord was very patient, and that's one of the lessons that we learn in reading Jeremiah and dealing with Manasseh, is that after you get through Jeremiah, you ask yourself, why has the Lord been so patient? But we're thankful that he is, and we're given a feel for what is the patience of the Lord. Kind of the same thing, just a little more graphical difference. We're focused, though, on this part, Judah alone, right? This is kind of past, but I didn't want to delete it. It took me a while to cut and paste those in, you know. So, again, Manasseh, Amon, Josiah, is sort of what it's what the Judah alone, but also, this is the Judah alone. So Nahum, that prophecy against Nineveh, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, are in play there. Although Isaiah kind of flows into some of Manasseh too there. So it's not exactly to scale in detail. So really, you know, we don't, you know, with Hezekiah, we have recorded to us that interaction, right, with Sennacherib's representative, with discussions about Assyrians coming in, what they did to the northern kingdom is going on. But we really don't have a lot of discussion about Assyria with regards to Manasseh, but he was under them, right, that whole time period. We'll kind of come back, a little bit, but, with, or actually what? We'll flip back. that you kind of say, when do we think maybe Manasseh was taken into captive where he had the change of heart? And that was potentially around 652 BC, because that would have been late in his reign. Babylon got hit pretty hard, pretty well leveled, actually, in a lot of ways from this revolt. That would have been a time period that would potentially have gotten Manasseh, because Babylon's revolt was really a big hassle to Assyria. The last great Assyrian ruler was Shurnapatapal, and he was the Assyrian of Assyria. You know, you were like, give me a textbook Assyrian ruler. He was. But what we see, if you look at history, you're spending more time talking about him, he really sows the seeds of the destruction of Assyria. It is like the Medes. He picks on the Medes. He wants their horses. So he gets them all riled up at him. Down where Persia is, Elam and all that, he obliterates them. So the people come in. Well, those are the people who are going to turn around and wreak havoc along with the Babylonians. So his rule ends around 627 BC, and 609, it's gone. I mean, well, Assyria actually destroyed 612. 15 years, less than 20 years after his passing, Assyria is gone. And that's that judgment. And if it's kind of interesting is if you do your years, somewhere around 623 BC is when Josiah begins his reform. Because after the death of Ashurnabal, Assyria is really out of it. They're crumbling. They're hit from every which way. And so Josiah is in much better position to do that, plus kind of his age. But it's kind of interesting how that all kind of hits in there. But really, when you're looking, you know, at Nahum and the time periods and stuff like that, it is, you know, when he's doing that prophecy, when Manasseh starts his reign, it is inconceivable that Assyria would be a total desolation to the point that, you know, Xerxes walks by and doesn't even know he's walked by Nineveh. So God bringing that punishment, you know. Really kind of Josiah, our last of our Judah alone, he finds out how much trouble they're really in, and then that leads to our fall of Judah, that with the passing with his sons, and that's kind of to understand that, you got to understand the sons of Josiah, but he's around 609, he's killed in battle with Necho. The Egyptians come back in 609. They kick him out, make Jehoiakim. So he's the kind of one of those Egyptians, the Babylonians. But in 605, the Babylonians and Egyptians fight it out and are defeated. They are crushed at Carchemish. And so around 605 is when that first deportation occurs. And then 597 is the second one, and that is with Ezekiel. And then 586 is the temple's destroyed, the city's destroyed, and everybody but the poor are pretty much let out. And also in this time period is Gedaliah, and again, a story I love, but just not what you cover in an Old Testament survey. Took three prophets to deal with this captivity, with this fall. Jeremiah was in the land with the bad figs. Ezekiel was in the captivity with the good figs. And Daniel was with the rulers, letting them know that God rules in the affairs of men. That this isn't the doing of the Babylonian gods. This is God bringing punishment to his people. His kids is Jehoahaz, about 3 months, then he's removed. Jehoiakim, we go to Jehoiachin, which he probably was the 18-year-old. Apparently did not rule long. He was taken over to Babylonian captivity, and then Zedekiah is the last king in the land. And so there I try to add those guys to that. So this part here in the bottom corner is that period of the fall of Judah. So just saying again, Necho 609 replaces Nebuchadnezzar, allows Jehoiakim to rule. Jehoiakim rebels. First captive's taken. Again, Jehoiakim rebels. Apparently dies in the siege. Jehoiakim captive. And then Zedekiah rebels. And before he is blinded and taken into captivity, he sees his family killed, and then he is blinded. Babylonians were not nice people. Now, we kind of gone through all of this, and we have this harsh judgment that we have from Jeremiah that's given, that the description's given about Manasseh. But Jeremiah 38, to me, is always interesting. Jeremiah comes to Zedekiah. Thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you will surrender to the officials of the kings of Babylon, then your life shall be spared, and the city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house shall live. But if you do not surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then this city shall be given into the hands of the Chaldeans, and they shall burn it with fire, and you shall not escape from their hand. King Zedekiah said to Jeremiah, I am afraid of the Judeans who have deserted to the Chaldeans, lest I be handed over to them, and they deal cruelly with me. I mean, God is ready. I mean, the judgment is there. They are under siege. And the mercy of God gives Zedekiah that opportunity, that chance for repentance, for mercy. And so it always hits me. Because, I mean, again, Jeremiah, you read through and you say, why has God been so patient with these people? And here you have God's mercy. And what gets Zedekiah? Fear. So, all right. Okay, you're still sharing, right? Okay.
Yes.
All right. So now we get finally, after a mere 30 minutes, we're now to the exile and the return. And of course, our question is actually about the return and actually kind of the end of the return, Nehemiah rebuilding the walls. But y'all have worked hard. Y'all stuck with this and all. So I thought we would do an easy breakout. So hopefully you think this is an easy breakout. So breakout, just the question is, what do you admire about Nehemiah? I think he's clearly, if you want to understand how to be a leader, looking at Nehemiah is very valuable. So that's our question. Any questions on the question? I don't see that. Nikki, break us up.
The pose. We don't hear Myrna, so we're not sure that she's on. Okay.
She's on.
Start us off, Paula.
All right, I'll be happy to start. Okay. He had a plum job as the cupbearer, and he was willing to leave that luxury and take on a colossal challenge to rebuild the wall.
Yep, that was mine. So you got mine. Oh. So I'm done.
Well, I thought I'd start with the beginning.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. And not only that, he kind of risked his position with the king to make the request, to show sadness in front of the king. And, yeah, I think probably, too, the endurance under stress that he shows when the job and the task is huge and the enemies are plotting to kill him, and he just continues to say, I've got work to do and it's God's work, and so I can't be bothered by these things. And he just puts his hand to the task and does it.
His leadership qualities are even in the world, we say, his leadership qualities are very good. Mm-hmm. Inside the church, but even those skills are used outside the church. How he organized the logistics of the families taking involved, he motivated, he prayed. There's not a bad, as biblical characters go, there's really not a bad side of him that we know, that we see, right?
Yeah, and he's in the front line. He just didn't sit back and watch and let all the people be his slaves and let them do the work. And he go to the front line and do the hard work himself.
Right. And he didn't take the
devil portion.
Yeah, he didn't take the governor's portion as a tax from the people, but he basically just ate what was needed for him and the household.
He was a great strategist because he checked everything out at night. And, you know, I've thought about that. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, it's very, very steep. On a hill. That, and you know, he didn't have lighting and whatever. That strategy just amazed me.
Mm-hmm.
And how the strategy of half the men standing guard and then the other half working.
Stop, Caleb.
Yeah, mother, his name is Spider-Man.
Spider-Man, yeah.
He'll tell
Spider-Man's on the toilet right now.
Daddy says, hey, Caleb, do this thing. And then he says, I'm not. I'm Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Or something.
Sometimes he won't answer to Caleb because he's Spider-Man.
Yes, he's Spider-Man.
And there's Spider-Woman, too, so.
Yeah. I think, too, just Nehemiah teamed up with some good people to get the work done. That's a requirement to accomplish such a task.
He didn't fall for the bad people trying to, bamboozle him?
Yeah, trying to trick him into coming and doing the work.
All right, we're all back, looks like. But for the most part, we hadn't lost too many folks, it didn't look like, and scared them off. So, John Trimble, what did your group come up with? Can you unmute and say what your group came up with, or can someone speak?
You may want to get somebody else. I got an announcement here.
Yep, you do. All right, who else was in John's group? All right, no one's willing to admit it, huh?
Miles was.
Throw him under the bus.
Yeah, well, one of the things was his preparation like his prayer upon hearing of the condition of the remnant in Jerusalem and its walls, his courage in requesting that the king send him to Judah to rebuild it, his action to request to correct the wrongs that were being done there, and he also didn't demand the food allowance that the governor, because the service was too heavy upon the people, and he asked them to remember him for the good that was being done for the people. And he persisted in building the wall in spite of the opposition of the nations around them. He was just an overall good leader.
Wow. Y'all hit about all of them, Miles. You didn't leave any for anybody else. Y'all hit, wow, I'm impressed. You had a good group. Let's see, Teresa, what group were you in?
I'm with Sewell led up the class.
All right, Sewell.
All right, a lot of what Miles said, we had, we mentioned his organization, that he was really well organized and everything, and had people given different responsibilities. Something was said of his faith, the fact that he was appointed governor of the area, and that he was actually in the same period when Ezra came and demanded the divorce of those that were married to pagans. And that plus what Miles listed would be what we had.
All right, that's pretty good. Terry, kind of his vision, which, I mean, again, is planning. And then just getting the people to work. He seemed to have that means to get the people to work. Nikki, I'm not sure. It looks like we might have lost Janice. I don't know if she's trying to get in. You can take a look.
I'm watching. That wasn't Janice, though. That was okay. Stan and Stan.
Okay. Thank you. Anyway, we lost them there. So, I kind of just a pop quiz. We won't break up. Maybe make y'all unmute. If you could just something that you think you've learned that has been most helpful to you from going through and doing this Old Testament survey. Is there anything that comes to mind that has been helpful in what we've tried to go over and do?
Hi, Daddy.
Yes, Teresa.
I'm still a little disorganized in my head, but what I'm getting out of it is the dates and stuff. That's something I've always wanted to learn, how to put the dates and the periods together. That's really helping me.
And I have worked hard on that because, you know, there's to a lot of people, that's what turns them off from history. But it's kind of those are the things that kind of give us a feel. So I'm glad that that has come a little bit better to you. And don't feel bad. There are a lot of people that have a hard time keeping those dates straight. But they really do help us kind of track things.
Didn't David come about 1,000 B.C.?
Yes.
That helps me. That's a thousand is easy a number to remember. And if you can spot David at about 1,000 B.C., then you can get to Solomon and even the divided kingdom pretty well in mind.
And then Moses would be 400 years before and that. So Sewell's right there, Teresa. Just think, try to remember, when was David king at 1,000? But that is a good one. I'm glad we've helped you some. Any other things that somebody wants to volunteer that's been most helpful to them or at least somewhat helpful to them in this class?
I liked all the slides, kind of a layered approach back to back where you showed the periods in terms of years and then in terms of the Bible books and then in terms of the geography. And there may have been another layer to that too, just kind of going at it from several different directions. And I liked, I think that's going to help me with the divided kingdom, the comparison between the Israelite dynasties and the and kind of separating into periods, as chunk it up a little bit.
Yeah, and that's most people, it just says divided kingdom, and that can be challenging. So it is helpful if you can kind of keep those dynasties. Sherry, you're unmuted, and you helped me come up with a question. So what's your answer?
You weren't supposed to tell that.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I think really what has helped me is seeing the survey aspect and seeing how through all that sweep of history, God was planning, he was guiding, he was promising and keeping his promises, he was steadfast. And right now, when things are so up and down and confusing and everything in just this little microcosm of time, it's comforting to think of that stability and that certainty and that planning and watching out for the people that were trying to obey him and being aware of the 7,000 who'd not bowed the knee to Baal, all those whom we don't know anything about. But God knew who they were, and he knew their hearts and was able to track them and care for them.
Thank you, Jerry. Excellent answer. Time for one more person.
Danny, I would follow up on Cherry in knowing that those are the crowd of witnesses cheering us on. And even though we don't feel that we're like them, I mean, these paramount figures, we can be encouraged to meet the challenge and keep on till the end of time, I mean, end of our lives, and to teach the next generation. That's paramount in us. We saw the mistakes, but that doesn't eliminate what we should do and our mission in God's plan. And I'm grateful today that I found that promise that Abraham had 2,000 years BC, and I'm part of that promise. I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, thank you, Paula. And you've helped segue very well into how we'll be ending the class. So thank you very much, and everybody for those answers. And again, hopefully have been useful. So let me try to share again, and we will finish up. And also, we still have the captivity in exile, a return from exile. And then we have kind of the wrap up. So we still got a good bit to go. So at least by the things that are happening on my windows on my computer, we should be sharing again. Is that correct? All right. Excellent. Thumbs up and head shakes. I can't go wrong. Okay. So kind of just pulled. I mean, y'all have hit this all very well and actually in many ways said it better. But just some of examples of how Nehemiah was a good leader, his prayer, his preparation, breaking that big project up into small projects, facing opposition, his generous nature, and his putting his faithfulness to God, or putting faithful, God-fearing men in charge. Just some small aspects, and y'all hit those and actually went well beyond. So we're now in this exile and return. So we're going from about 600 BC to about 525. So we're covering about 125 years here, more or less. So 609, we have where Jehoiakim becomes king, replaced there that the people didn't choose. They were now in control of other folks. His rebellion. Daniel's taken into captivity in 605. Ezekiel's in the second one in 597. And so in 586, Nebuchadnezzar destroys Jerusalem and the temple. So there's that 70 years, and we're going to be talking more about that. And it's an interesting kind of look. If you look at the 70 years, Jeremiah's prophet says, you didn't give the land rest. God's going to give the land rest. So that's kind of where that 7 years, 70 years comes. And it can be kind of an interesting study how you kind of look at time to come up with that. The people return in 538 with Zerubbabel. They start the temple. They get the altar rebuilt. And then the work stops. And then Haggai, Zechariah saying, finish the temple. They resume. They finish it in 516 B.C. thereabouts. And so that temple, and then again, the thing is that those who could remember Solomon's temple just weeped at the outline, at the size and, you know, simplicity of the temple compared to what it was. Esther's in this period around 473 BC. And then what you don't really realize is Ezra comes in 457. He's not with Zerubbabel in that crowd. He's with the group that comes back in 457. And then not too many years later, Nehemiah is there. So here, just kind of, you know, continuing the theme, the middle schoolers tend to like these slides when I do them. Anyway, here, you know, we had our Judah alone, the fall of Judah there with his sons of Josiah. And then during the captivity, of course, there's Nebuchadnezzar, bigger than life, kind of fellow. And so that's Daniel, Ezekiel is around in that time period. And of course, Zedekiah. I mean, you know, Daniel, when he left, the temple was there, the city was there. There was a king. But then, you know, at the end of his life and the people are returning, the temple is gone, and there is no physical king. Just a kind of interesting historical note, you kind of have Nebuchadnezzar, you have, look, this guy's evil, Merodach. During his time, there's actually a cuneiform that says, list the rations for Jehoiakim, that's given there. And then Belshazzar is the other. And if you look, I mean, really, there's a few kings. There's not a lot of kings really of significance, really, after Nebuchadnezzar. But it is Belshazzar that we have that famous writing on the wall, many, many tickle Euphrasera. And I think I should, it's not in this set. Marty has the perfect translation of that into nickel, nickel, whatever kind of thing. But you have Daniel, and Daniel is the really key part of kind of understanding a lot about the captivity and really what's coming after that captivity. So showing it again, three groups being deported and at least three groups, and I think there's a fourth small group that comes back. The thing that really kind of that comes to our mind, or something that should really, again, is a good piece of evidence showing that God is here, he's in control, he's setting these events in place, is for some reason Isaiah talks about Cyrus. Now, normally in a prophecy, a given name is not mentioned, but Isaiah, in around 700 BC, he talks about Cyrus liberating. He talks about the captivity. And so about 170, 200 years less or whatever, Cyrus frees the people. That's whereas the Assyrians and the Babylonians moved people out of the land, that the Persians said, we're going to move the people back. We're going to give them an opportunity to come back. So it wasn't just Israel that was allowed to return to their homelands. And they found, I think, more than one of these cylinders, but on this particular one was found in Tigris. And here is Cyrus's proclamation that it is I'm gathered. I return to those sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, the sanctuaries of which had been ruins for a long time. the images which were used to live therein, and establish for them permanent sanctuaries. I also gathered all their former inhabitants and returned them to their habitations. So, you know, it isn't just Judah alone who's returned. They're part of that. And there's that specific kind of decree that's given to them. But Isaiah says, you know, Cyrus, he's my shepherd. You know, he shall build to the temple, your foundation shall be laid. I mean, it's kind of just all that being laid out. And again, this is almost 200 years before the actual events. So again, just to kind of keep your in mind the time periods, that Zerubbabel, that's that first group around 538 BC, Ezra 458, Nehemiah. So we also will kind of talk about that rebuilding. So Zerubbabel, we think of rebuilding the temple, Ezra reforming the people. I mean, asking people to put away their wives, to divorce their wives because they're not right to be married to them, is not an easy thing today, so don't think it was an easy thing back then. And the people listened. They, you know, that's the critical thing. They listened to Ezra, but that giving of the law, getting the people back into the purity, the sanctification, and then, of course, Nehemiah rebuilding the wall. This, again, just the same thing that I've kind of laid out again. It's just in a different format so that if the others are too busy, the map's too overwhelming or whatever, you have that same information. And then Malachi, our last kind of word from God as far as a prophet, a written book, is in around 430 BC. Here, again, the same information, but just kind of artistic and me throwing a few things in, rebuild the temple, rebuild worship, the law, rebuild the walls. Ezra, again, you know, we talk about leadership of Nehemiah, but boy, Ezra, that was a hard job, right? To the people to get them. He, you know, was a skilled scribe, skilled in the law of Moses, but the Lord, the God of Israel, had given, and the king granted him all that he asked, for the hand of the Lord his God was on him. And so there in Ezra 7, for on the first day of the first month, he began to go up from Babylonian, and on the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem, for the good hand of his God was on him. So that also is about a four-month trip. You wonder, how long does it take to get to Babylon to Jerusalem? About 4 months. And then there in verse 10, for Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach his statutes and rule in Israel. I'm sorry, we are going way over time. Y'all all okay? All right. I think one of the most powerful things is that, you know, the people, they were to read the law to the people. Every 7 years, the law was to be read. And this is, you know, one of the few occasions that we have it recorded. And so Ezra brought the law before the assembly, both men and women and all who could understand what they heard on the first day of the seventh month. And he read it from it facing the square before the water gate from morning until midday. In the presence of the men and the women and those who could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. They wanted to hear. I mean, you hear that description given. It just reminds me when you look at church history. I mean, the Bishop Bible, they had to chain down to the podium, because the people wanted to read the Bible for themselves and coming in. And so that was, I mean, those Bibles, they had to chain them because the people's great desire to read. And so that, I think, is one of the things that we're so fortunate in our efforts in teaching folks is, I mean, we have the absolute truth. We have God's plan, and that thirst is there for, you know, it's a unique book. All right, so we've kind of talked about Nehemiah. Malachi, we just kind of hit. I love when I taught the middle school that we describe in Malachi, we say, you're robbed God. And, you know, so you kind of wake them up. Not too many middle schoolers are able to sleep when you say you've robbed God. But the people were, again, just falling into just more actions physically. They're not doing what they should. And then we have kind of another Malachi statement that reminds us that importance to put the plumb line against God's word, and that's what we do. But, you know, the end of Malachi, behold, I will send you an Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So there, as the prophecies end, for what most people think of prophecies, we say, get ready, look for Elijah, and then we're introduced to John the Baptist. So we kind of alluded that there's another prophet in play, and that is Daniel. Daniel gets us through those years of silence. Daniel roars through those years of silence. But when we look kind of what we've talked about, you know, the people, there was a return of the people, that proclamation of Cyrus, the return to the land, the temple altars rebuilt, the temples rebuilt, the laws returned, the walls are returned, but what hasn't returned? The king. Where's the king? Well, Daniel tells us about where the king is, all right? Where the king is going to return. So one of the greatest prayers, and I thought of doing this class just at looking at prayers. I would have had to completely redo a lot of my slide decks to get that. But Daniel has a prayer to God that Cyrus has come. Daniel there kind of just, these are picking out parts of his prayer, kind of well into it. Now, therefore, our God, hear the prayer of your servant and his supplications. For the Lord's sake, cause your face to shine on your sanctuary, which is desolate. So they're kind of asking, Lord, let us go back. Let us be able to take care of your sanctuary. Oh, my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see our desolation in the city which is called by your name. For we do not present our supplications to you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great mercies. Daniel realizes it's God's mercy. It's not our righteousness. It is God's mercy. And then, O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act. Do not delay for your own sake, my God, for your city and for your people are called by your name. So Daniel's very aware of Jeremiah. He's very aware of that 70 years. And so there he's asking, Lord, hear our supplication. And he's fortunate as a prophet, he gets a pretty quick answer. And now while I was speaking, praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I have seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out. And I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. So Daniel's prayer is answered. And that would be the Cyrus, right, proclamation. We have Ezra records for us that proclamation from Cyrus letting the people return. I will just say, kind of, Marty, when he teaches Daniel, I think does a good job of pointing out, and I've had to kind of go through, and I had some things not quite rightly shown on my slides. But, you know, 609, you know, Jehoahaz gets kicked out. But the first time being taken into captivity is 605. So you would think, you know, 535, if you figured 70 years of captivity. But it falls short of that. So if 605 is the start of the 70 years, what has the Lord done? He's shown mercy, right? He's answered Daniel's prayer early. Now, there's a couple other 70 years in there. It gets to be an interesting tracking that. But I got to say, I like Marty's thinking on this, that if you do look at the 70-year aspect from 605, the Lord showed mercy and has let his people go home a little early. So that's not for me. I stole that all from Marty and probably haven't said it nearly as well. Most people might not think, you know, you think Daniel, you think the lion's den, the fiery furnace, these are sort of the things. Daniel 14, or Daniel 10 there, part of what's being given, the Lord is saying, hey, what's going to ready to happen? Now, I've come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the revision refers to many days yet to come. And so what that is Daniel kind of 11 is a survival guide for between the testaments. And so thus my saying, Daniel roars between the testaments. It's really 90 years of silence. Daniel 11 is the most detailed prophecy we have anywhere. Pretty much, I mean, you look at Psalms 22, I mean, but for as far as history, if you're a history person, I mean, it's amazing that it lays out there. So the one, of course, we think of is the figure, Babylon, the head of gold, the silver, the Medo-Persians, bottom torso part, the Greeks, and then the legs of the Romans. And then in that last day, something's going to come there. And so those are years there. So this is, I'm sorry, I really have gone, I know, way too long, and we're not done yet. But I think it's kind of important, or at least I want to talk about these things, is that when you look at prophecy, they need to be short range, medium range, long range, messianic. So there, Daniel, that's short range. I mean, the Babylon that's occurring there. Talking about the Persians, you know, that's 70 years to go. So that's medium range. That's within the life of a prophet. We normally define that. The Greeks, where do the Greeks come from? You know, it's kind of interesting. But Alexander Great hits that. And so that's beyond the life of Daniel. That's sort of our long range. And then we're talking about those legs and the feet of clay and iron. But more important, we are told that in the days of the kings of God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And thus that messianic is given there. So chapter 11 kind of gives us more of that detail of what's going on there. So we look over. We don't know what's on the other side of that bridge, right? We're crossing it. We got about 400 years that we've got to cross. And so Daniel lists out events that are occurring over that. Now, it's not like with these prophecies that you're going to say, oh, Alexander the Great's going to come. You know, that's not what you see going forward. But what you see, if you're that kind of the faithful, waiting for those promises, living through those difficult times, you read Daniel 11, several chapters actually on Alexander the Great, parts of prophecy, and what do you realize? 200 years, actually, yeah, 200 years after Daniel, these events start to happen. And you're saying, Daniel wrote about these. And it tells you who's in control? Who has made these promises and is in control? And we're waiting for that return of the King, God. And I just, it's very powerful. There is, I think, some questions about if Daniel 11:45 is Augusta. I have a hard time putting somebody else there. But the Roman Empire controls. His tent is pitched over all of the Mediterranean world. And so, you know, I think that kind of, in other words, Daniel has taken us from the days of Cyrus to the Roman Empire to Augusta. And guess what's getting ready to be formed? That kingdom that shall last forever. That whole part of the New Testament survey that we're going to have. It's coming. And Daniel takes us to there. He gets us to that point. And so there in Daniel 12:4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. You know, people running. Alexander the Great, he's coming. He's destroying everything. What's going to happen to us? The Lord, God, has told you. He's coming. He's going to be like, you know, just a wind going over the world and wreaking havoc. And so those who live by faith can turn there and have that to know God's in control and those promises are still in effect. And so we come to the New Testament. Luke 2:1 says, in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augusta that all the world should be registered, setting into motion where Jesus is going to be born, where the Messiah is going to become. And we're told now Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. And behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw a star when it rose and have come to worship. So those guys, they hung out. They read Daniel. And they knew, and they were looking, and they were given a sign. I don't know exactly what that sign was, but they were given the sign, and they came. And so this whole set of promises, which we're going to go over yet again, we're going to cycle back through before you're done with me, but they have come. And so that promise that in those days shall be established a king which shall last forever. The king is returned, and it's not a physical king, right? It's going to be a spiritual king. It's a whole different kingdom that's come. Now, I'm sorry. I have gone way over time. This has nothing to do with the Old Testament survey, but this is some neat archaeology, and you're stuck hearing it for a few minutes. You know, we're told, Mary, they came. They could not find. Well, you know, first of all, they have the census. They have to go to Bethlehem. And so they're told, you know, you have to go there. She's expecting a child. And they're told there's no room in the inn. Well, I think most of you have heard that inn doesn't mean Holiday Inn. That generally it is a upper room. That the upper room is where you put the rich people or the rich or the honored guests. That's where they would go. So kind of that Greek word means that upper room there. So there's not room for them there. So where there is room is in the manger. Now, one thing is people lived with animals. I mean, you look at the houses of that period, you look at the period of the Old Testament, they lived with animals. It wasn't too uncommon, but in a larger complex, you know, there would be this place for the animals. And then what they would do is, again, they had this kind of stall or places where they would put the food. And what they put the food in was called a manger. Now, sometimes it could be a rock manger, but in this case, Lynn is showing us wooden boxes, and so it was in one of those boxes that the animals were fed, is that manger where it talks about Jesus being put. And again, they were on the side where the food was, the animals were on the other side. And what it kind of excites me is when I went to Capernaum. Capernaum is a whole city of lava rocks. That's what it's built of. But there in the corner is one of the buildings there. It's been put together are those same kind of stalls where the animals could get their food. So, yeah. I'm sorry, Florine. It is a little small there. So, I'm sorry. I just, in the last month, this has come up, and y'all are victims. Okay. So, as we've talked about the promise, all right? Promise was made of Abraham, of a nation, of land and sea, seed. We talked about the nation actually being they come out of the land, they become a great people. That giving of the law, that Old Testament covenant, that Mosaic covenant sets them apart, sanctifies them, makes them a nation. The land, boy, you know, the sojourning, the conquest, the judges, the United Kingdom, the Judah alone, the captivity, the return, all of that's occurring in the land. And then the important thing is the seed. And then we go to the New Testament there in Acts 3. You know, you are sons of the prophets and of the covenant which God made with our father, saying to Abraham, and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. To you first, God, having raised up his servant Jesus, sent him to bless you in turning away every one of you from your iniquities. So that's the New Testament survey. We're going to be kind of going through that. But there's the seed promise. And where did it start? Where did it begin? Way back there with Adam and Eve, right? And then we get more information with Abraham and those three direct promises. And I've been trying, you know, it's been following through there. And then in Galatians, now to Abraham and his seed are the promises made. And he does not say, and to seeds, as many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ. That is the king. That is who is the king returned. And Daniel was given, although he was given insight, how much he understood, I don't know. Because we're told the prophets really wanted to know, and I'm understanding, but that is that. And so, again, looking at these prophecies, you know, Deuteronomy, the blessings and curses given in 1400 B.C., some 800 years later, the people are not faithful. They're taken into captivity. Psalms 22 gives us the crucifixion. 1,000 years later, that crucifixion, we're given the details. Isaiah, land led to slaughter around 700 BC, 30 AD is given. Cyrus, given to us in Isaiah, 170 years, Cyrus is on the scene, and what does he decide to do? He's going to let all the people go back home. And then Jeremiah, that promise of 70 years, and Daniel's looking, he's counting the years, and he knows that time is there. So, again, just an opportunity to kind of get you a feel, to get those years in your mind. Because as Teresa said, it's very hard for us a lot of times when we cover these years to really get the magnitude of how long before the events that these prophecies were given. And then... here, this is kind of hopefully my relationship curve. You got it on one slide, the Old Testament survey. It's here that we start in the beginning, Adam and Eve, the tree of good and evil, sin enters the world, the people come so bad, it's flooded, the wickedness of men, Noah finds favor, a promise is given to Abraham, that promise is also given to Isaac, Jacob. And they're told, you're going to be a sojourner for 400 years in Egypt. Moses you know, I am the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob. That promise again is given. Joshua, who's this day are you going to serve? Judges, another generation after them who did not know God, the people. I mean, this is going, and it goes on. It's not, we're human nature is still the same. There's this need again to look at that plumb line. We've talked about David. We've talked about the weakness of Jeroboam and not having faith in God and introducing the calf worship. Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, none like him, because Manasseh committed those abominations, disasters upon Jerusalem and Judah. The punishment was coming. Therefore, my wrath shall be aroused against this place, shall not be quenched. The plumb line is just too far off. The prayer of Daniel, confession, you know, be merciful. We've sinned. We deserve everything you've given. But let us go home. Let us give proper worship to you. Let us get your sanctuary rebuilt. And Ezra set his heart to study, to teach the law. And then, you know, we're left with these last kind of words of Malachi, because that's people. They just generate. It's so important to teach those generations. But at the time of Malachi, these words are given. You have wearied the Lord. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way. And so that kind of brings us to an end on our Old Testament survey. It's only been an hour and a half, and y'all have all been good and faithful. Thank you. Any last questions or comments?
Thank you very much, Danny.
I just want to thank you very much. You did a wonderful job. I'm glad you took the time to do the rest of it.
Thank you, Danny.
All right, you're welcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
I might want to steal some of your slides in the future.
You're welcome to. I've stolen. I have cherry picked some of the best and tried to enhance them some. So you're welcome to anything.
You've been very generous. Thank you.
Danny.